What's up? It is nice to hear that intro song because it means I'm back. Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricardo Verandes, also known as Ricky Verandes. And yes, I can still roll my R's. We have a great episode for you today. I practice what I preach. I always say that you should be willing to see all perspectives and opinions and take things in to help mold your vision of the world and your understanding of things. And I've had a lot of libertarians in the past, and I'm always willing to talk to people, statists, libertarians, lobbyists. I've had Jack Abramoff on. I've had Roger Stone on. I don't agree with all their views and all the things they say, like many of my guests. But if they're saying something that I think is worth considering or something that's worth promoting, even if they have some things that I think are worth challenging, I'll still have them on. And I think that's super important. Like I told Professor Wolf, and I'm sure you guys have, It's Professor Wolf. And I've told you guys before, I'm not married to any idea. And I think it's very important to have your ideas challenged and to challenge, of course, other people's ideas, but also be open to having your ideas challenged. And what I mean by that is when people challenge your ideas, don't just get defensive and push back and try to just have a intelligent response, but really analyze, dissect, why do I believe this? And does it make sense? And I think that's very important. Self-reflection and trying to understand what you believe and why you believe it is something that's very difficult to do, because obviously a lot of times we have some emotional, sometimes we have some emotional reasons to why we back one thing or the other. Maybe you're anti-unions because you grew up in a family that hated unions. Maybe you're pro-union because you grew up in a family that loves unions. And neither one is right or wrong all the time. So I think it's really important to try to, or maybe you're a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian or Socialist or Marxist, whatever it may be, because of somebody telling you that that's what's right and this is what's wrong. So I think, you know, kind of being able to cut through that is super important. And that's what I constantly try to do with myself. That's why I have people on that, you know, they'll say something that makes sense. And I'll be like, you know what? That makes absolute sense. I get that. That's a really good idea. And it doesn't matter if they're a statist, a libertarian, a socialist, whatever it may be. I think we just have to look at ideas. And, you know, Karl Marx, that was a big thing of his, is the importance of ideas. And you know, ideas is what molds the way we have our society, molds our cultures, molds all these things. So I definitely think that dissecting them and trying to figure out which ones are the best and make the most sense is very important. And like I said, challenging your ideas. But today we have on Professor Richard Wolf, somebody I'm a fan of. He is very open to doing what I love, and that's having discussions with people who he agrees with and people who he disagrees with, who are willing to challenge his ideas and push back. And I think that's very important. He was a professor of economics at UMass Amherst. He also taught at Yale. I believe he's a visiting professor at New School University, New York City. He also taught at a university in France. I mean, he's traveled the world. He's very intelligent, very well-spoken, very fun to have a conversation with. And he's also an author. He wrote Rethinking Marxism. He wrote Capitalism Crisis, Understanding Marxism, Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. So he's written a bunch of stuff. And he also has appeared on The Empire Files, which if you haven't seen it, it's a great show. You can find it on YouTube by Abby Martins. Her brother, Robbie Martins, has been on in the past a bunch of times, so you can check those out. But Empire Files are like, a lot of the episodes are just short little documentaries, like maybe 20 to 40 minutes. His first appearance on the show, they did just kind of the background and the history of Marxism and Karl Marx, which was super fascinating. And I'm sure, as you guys know, Abby Martins is very pro-socialism. So obviously that's one reason she had him on. He's also been on shows like Tom Hartman's radio show, and he's been on RT a bunch of times. So very fascinating guy. I'm sure you probably will recognize his voice or his name. And also remember, speaking of capitalism, if you want to help support the show, the music that you hear in the beginning of the show, all my music, it's by my solo project called Theory 6. You can find that music anywhere you can get digital downloads, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, etc. Also, I have a Patreon page. If you're a Patreon supporter, I'll let you know in advance, like I'm sure my Patreon supporters read on the Patreon post, that Richard Wolff was going to be on today. You'll know in advance who's booked and when they're going to be on. So it just gives you a little reason, I guess one more reason to kind of support the show if you kind of like that behind the scenes information, because for the most part, you don't know who's going to be on until I post the show. So you kind of know in advance, and you can also share any ideas you might have for the show, any questions you might want me to ask. You can kind of share that on the Patreon page, and I can, I can forward that, because I love suggestions. So I think that's it for now. I have a bunch of great guests that I'm working with right now, trying to schedule and trying to figure things out. So hopefully it won't be long until the next episode is out. I really, 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 really appreciate everybody's patience. Life does get in the way, and sometimes it's just a matter of finding a time that works for everybody. So it gets hard. But obviously, with this being a passion project, even though I do have a little bit of income, it doesn't cover the cost of what it takes to run this thing. But it's a passion project, like I said. So I enjoy doing it, and I think these conversations are super important and worth going through the time and trouble and financial, I guess, investment it may take to continue doing this. And that's it. You know, I really do find enjoyment in this. And of course, I always get tons of positive feedback, which gives me tons of motivation to continue this. And it's just nice to know that people are enjoying the show. They aren't sick of hearing my voice. They accept my incredible idea, or my incredible ability to still suck at interviewing sometimes, even though I've been doing it for a while now. And sometimes gathering my thoughts can be hard, but with all my flaws, you guys still love the show, and it seems like for the most part, you guys still love me. So I really appreciate that. And everybody who's hit me up, and I consider you guys friends. I love the fact that we can connect from time to time, and feel free. With that said, feel free to follow me on Instagram, Twitter. We have a YouTube channel, RV Theory 6, where you can see. Well, you can listen to all the podcasts, but also if anybody calls in using video, like Professor Wolff did today, you can visually see us have the conversation. So if you guys ever want to see who I'm talking to or see if somebody called in using video, go on our YouTube channel. You can actually see us have the discussion. And so that's always, you know, I guess a little better than just hearing our voices. And on my YouTube channel, there's other reasons to go there too. I have a documentary playlist that has tons of just great documentaries, thought-provoking documentaries that you can check out if you're ever just looking for something to watch. Obviously, YouTube has gotten very strict with what they're letting on their platform. So quite often I go on there and find out that documentaries are deleted, or somebody will hit me up and say, hey, I can't find that documentary anymore. So go on there and watch the thought-provoking, controversial documentaries while they're still there. And also, I'm thinking of starting a playlist called Ricky's Rants or Rick's Rants or something like that, where I can kind of shrink these intros. And also, maybe when there's big gaps between podcasts, I can just put out some content by just kind of sharing what's going on in my life, maybe some interesting movies or music or ideas that have been consuming my brain. Just sharing some of that with you, and some, I guess, just whatever's on my mind, and just seeing if is that something you guys would be interested in. You think it's something you would watch, and I could do them maybe once a week or twice a week, and or whenever the hell, I guess, I have something interesting to say. And you know, they could be short, they could be long. I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll attempt one or two and see how it goes, if I can talk by myself for that long or not. But we'll figure out. I mean, you're probably thinking, of course you can talk for that long. It's 10-minute intro. but anyways, but thanks again, guys. I really appreciate it. And check out the at the YouTube channel, like I said, RVTheory6, my Twitter account, RVTheory6, Instagram, RVTheory6, our Facebook page, you can just search the Ripple Effect Podcast, you'll find it, or you can find me, Ricky Verandas, on Facebook and throw me a friend request. Just let me know that you're a fan of the show so I don't think you're some spam or some robot or some chick or dude trying to send me nude pics. So that's it. Thanks again, guys, and I will see you guys on the next one. Love you all. Peace. How's everything?
Okay, how are you?
Good, good. Can you hear me?
Yep, clearly.
Awesome, and I can hear you good too.
Good.
I think we're good to go. Well, thank you so much for being with me. I'm a huge fan of your work. I've been trying to get you on for a while now, and I know you're a busy guy doing interviews and debating people, and which I love, because I think these conversations, I tell people all the time, I'm like, you don't learn anything from talking to people you agree with. You learn from talking to people you disagree with, who might force you to look at things from a different perspective. So I love the fact that you're so willing to have conversations with people that you don't agree with and open to their ideas and also
absolutely
I think we're missing that in public. Now it just seems like everybody's one side or the other, and they're very ignorant in regards to being open to hearing other people's perspectives. And you see it in politics, you see it, you know, I say the way we looked at sports now has kind of overlapped everything, you know, the way I'm a Patriots fan, so, you know, I'm going to defend them till the end of time. That's kind of the way we debate everything now. It's just like you defend your team no matter what, and nobody's really open to looking at new information or new perspectives. So, you know, I think these type of conversations are really important. But I think we are moving in the right direction, because it does seem like, you know, somebody like Bernie Sanders, who's running and using the term socialist, it's not demonized the way it was before. I mean, at one point we're invading countries because there was, you know, in Central America and South America, because there were socialists, and that was the justification for it. And now, you know, we're actually a quite popular candidate, even though he looks like he's going to get screwed again, is running, and people are okay with using that term. But I guess to get back to, because I think one of the reasons I want to have you on is because I constantly get in conversations with people, and you'll use the term Marxism or socialism, and people, or communism, and people immediately demonize them, like they were designed to be corrupt and evil, and they don't work, and all this stuff. And you learn fairly quickly in a conversation that they don't quite know what they mean, and it's really just, you know, they're falling into... you know, I don't know who said it. If you say something a lie enough times, it becomes true. If you keep saying socialism is bad and all these isms are evil, then people tend to believe them, even though they don't necessarily know the definition of them. So before we get into Karl Marx, how did you get interested in socialism, Marxism? What piqued or sparked your interest in this philosophy? Because really, to me, I think it's important that outside of economics, it really is a philosophy at first, right?
Absolutely. And it's easy to tell the story of my upbringing and how I came to it. I was born in a place called Youngstown, Ohio, right in the middle of the United States. My father was pushing a wheelbarrow in a steel factory, because Youngstown, Ohio used to be one of the centers of the American steel industry when we had a big and thriving steel industry. We don't have that anymore, because big steel companies decided they could make more profits going somewhere else, first inside the United States and then to other countries. Anyway, when I was about 5 years old, having lived in Ohio, Missouri, and Colorado, my parents came east and brought me and my sister with them. And I grew up in a suburb of New York City after that. And here's what basically happened. My father lived in this suburb, but he worked in New York City like millions of other people. And so he took a commuting train every day from the town in which I grew up, called New Rochelle, outside of New York, into the city. It's a ride of about 35 minutes. And the interesting thing about the train was it went through a part of New York City on an elevated track so you could see what was going on. And the part of the city it went through was called Harlem. And it was a place where basically African-American people lived, and they didn't have any money. And it was obvious when you looked from the window of the train going by that they didn't have any money, because you could often see right into the apartment, because the train, elevated train, is at the level of the apartments in an apartment building. And I remember being a little kid and turning to my father and saying, what is this all about? My father was white, my mother was white, I'm white, and all the rest. And my father explained it to me. He explained to me that this is a society in which some people are denied the opportunities, the income, the jobs, the schooling, et cetera, that other people are. And he was very blunt. He said, it's not fair, it's not just, it's not right. But it's been going on for a long time. It produces bad results, both in the African-American community that suffers it and in the white community. And he explained to me how both sides are damaged by this way of organizing society. And that was my beginning. You know, he didn't mean to make me a left winger or anything. It was his way of answering his child's perfectly reasonable question about something that was perfectly obvious every time we passed in the train in that area. And then to finish it, when I went to college, I wanted to learn why this is. You know, basically, why are some people rich and other people poor and other people in the middle? It's the same question Adam Smith asks when he titles his book, The Wealth of Nations, because he says very clearly, I want to understand why are some nations rich, other nations poor, and other nations in the middle. So I mean, I had the same question. And then I discovered something that really affected me, that when I asked my professors questions that had to do with this system and what made it work this way, and are there systems that might not make it work this way? You know, I was a reasonably sensitive young 18, 19-year-old person, and I could see the fear on their faces. They didn't want to answer that question. When I began to push, as I learned a little bit, and I asked about socialism as an alternative, the fear turned to panic. And these were nice people. They were good teachers. I liked them. It wasn't that. But something was really... And then to make, again, long story short, I learned that it was a taboo, that in order to be a successful professor, to have any career advancement hopes in your mind, you better toe the line. You better not speak out of turn. You better not show any sympathy. So they decided they didn't want to go anywhere near this, like a little child with a hot stove. Keep your fingers away from that. So they got nervous when I asked a question, and they got more nervous when I pushed. So I went and did it on my own. You know, the library is full of books, and there's loads of them about Marxism and socialism and all the rest of it. So I began, you know, a little bit like a child who's told you can't go in the cookie jar. Well, those cookies look even more attractive when you're told you can't go. And look, I admit it, the Marxism, the socialism was attractive to me because it was a taboo. It was like learning about sex or something else that was interesting that I was told not to go too close to. I got more interested, not less. And again, then I like to finish it this way. The more I read, the more sense it made to me. The more I asked questions and saw that my professors either couldn't answer the question or were afraid to answer the question. And that kept going throughout my entire undergraduate and graduate years. So by the time I was done, here's the irony. It was this system, capitalism, that I lived in, born in the United States, lived here all my life, worked in this system since I've been a teenager. It was this system that convinced me we can do better than this system, because I believe human beings have it in them to get beyond running around the woods eating nuts and berries, and we can get beyond slavery, and we can get beyond feudalism. and we can get beyond this system too. I don't think history has come to an end. I wouldn't even know what sense it makes to say such a thing. And therefore, I like the idea that human beings, and I'm one of them, look about themselves and say, can we do better than what we are doing? And then go to work to try to achieve that. I'm proud that I've done it. I'm proud to be part of a species of animal that does that. And that's why I am who I am.
Yeah, it's weird because you think about it, like since the beginning of civilizations, you know, we produced tools and the wheel and fire, and everything was to kind of give us more free time. It was always like, okay, we found a quicker way, an easier way of doing this, so now we have more free time. And at some point, you know, working became just a thing that was supposed to consume your life. And, you know, I've had a Thaddeus Russell on, and he talks about our Puritan ancestors and how, and it's true. It seems like work is looked at like it's always a good thing. It doesn't matter if it's fulfilling. It doesn't matter if you get some type of enjoyment out of it. It's always a good thing. If you meet somebody who says, hey, you know what? I don't want to work overtime. I'd rather paint or whatever. People look down upon them. Like, you know, that's not somebody I want my daughter to date. He's lazy. He doesn't want to take the hours. You know, we have a small little, I live in Massachusetts. I live in Ludlow, Massachusetts, which is near Springfield, Massachusetts. And, you know, small little construction company, and you constantly hear from other employers like, oh, you know, kids these days are so lazy. They don't want to work overtime. They don't want to stay. I'm like, well, maybe there's some value in their free time. Isn't their free time valuable?
Absolutely. Like, you know, and absolutely. If I could interrupt.
Oh, absolutely.
Every major invention was justified by the inventor and the people who used it on the grounds, exactly as you say, to give us the freedom. And by freedom, I don't mean laziness, not at all. If you love what you do, you won't be lazy in doing it. But part of the reason people misdiagnose young folks and others who don't want to work as being lazy is they don't want to face the fact that the work they're being asked to do most of the time in our society is awful work. Look, I mean, let me do it in the form of a joke. If you live, by the way, you and I have more in common than we knew. Most of my adult life, I was a professor at the University of Massachusetts, just up the road from you in Amherst.
Yep.
You know, and so, I mean, I know the area really well. But I like to tell my students this joke. Outside of most workplaces in the United States, when you're done at the end of the day, about 5 o'clock, you're finished, you fold up your tools or you close your desk and turn off your computer or whatever, and you grab your coat and you head on toward your home. And along the way between your job and your home, you pass a window which has in big letters on it, happy hour. And now, why do you think they would have called stopping in for a drink happy hour? Because they were letting everybody know that they understood that the previous hours in your day, those before 5 o'clock, were not your happy hour. And so, but you know, that's not necessarily true. I love being a teacher. It's been the best decision I made in my life. I don't need to have a happy hour after. Are there some bad days? Sure. Is it always a joy? No, of course not. But in general, this is a job I like, and I think I'm better at it because it is enjoyable. It draws on many of my skills and my capacities. I develop as a person. I meet all kinds of people. I have the satisfaction of maybe teaching a little bit and so forth and so on. I think you get the most out of people if you help them find work they love, work that means something to them, whether it's music or art or technical work of one kind or another. We have lots of capacities. We can find work for everybody that's meaningful. We don't live in a system that does that. We live in a system driven by making profit, not by making people happy. And then we're always just find it alarming that there are so many unhappy people. My wife is a psychotherapist. To talk to her, you learn real quick just how unhappy most people in this society are. And if we were honest about it, we'd all be talking, not necessarily about socialism, but we would be talking about what is it about a society where so many people, hardworking, good people, are so unhappy, so lonely, so unsatisfied, so embittered. That's not, blaming them gets you nowhere. You got to understand why they came to that. They're no more happy in that condition being it than we are looking at them. And that has to be faced. And that's part of why I am a radical or a critic of society, because I'm surrounded by perfectly good people who are not able to lead the kinds of lives I would wish on them, they would wish for themselves. And you know something? If they were, we'd all live a better life because they weren't embittered, frustrated, lonely, and all the rest.
Well, I completely agree with you. I think people tend to believe that the most motivated people and who are creating the things we love are all motivated by money. But you look at, you know, the best artists, the best musicians, painters, Nikola Tesla, you know, some of the best thinkers, philosophers, they've all been motivated by their work. You know, they've been motivated by their passion to complete something or figure something out and or get better at something. And usually the ones who, you know, look at the 80s metal scene, you know, right? Everybody's like, oh, if we just put a bunch of hairspray in our hair and wear these heels, we can make money playing this music too. But it was the ones that were good at it and did it because they loved it. Those are musicians that continue, not the ones who try to jump on a bandwagon for financial gain. And you see that throughout history. So I think there's a good book, I can't remember the title now, that's about like what really motivates people. And it's you know, just kind of dissects this idea that it's always capitalism that brings us all the technology and the art and things we love. And a lot of times it's what suppresses those things. I mean, you watch documentaries like Who Killed Electric Car? You look at, you know, the light bulb conspiracy, you know, when all these people came together and said, hey, we can't make light bulbs, you know, live this long or last this long because we're going to go out of business. Same thing with the trolley car thing that happened in the U.S., you know, DuPont, GM, a couple companies came together, started a front company, bought all the trolley cars, you know, shut them down, got rid of the company, and then opened up, you know, started pushing, you know, diesel-powered PVTAs. And it's just, you know, so it's like in some cases, or in many cases, you can, there's good examples of planned obsolescence, this idea of not, you know, making sure it doesn't. So, you know,
I can add to it on a personal level. I haven't been a professor of economics all my adult life. I could have, because I'm interested in economics, and I could have gone into business. I could have made much more money. You don't make a lot of money if you're a professor. You know, you're comfortable, but you're never going to be rich. You're never going to have, you know, all the glitzy stuff. But it's the best decision I ever made. If I had gone into high finance, here's what I'd be doing. I'd be straining my brain every day to move a ton of money from one rich person into the hands of another, from one big corporate. Instead, I'm spending my time helping young people who want to understand how the world works, learn about it, get better at it, figure it out, and maybe help make it a better place. I go home at night, I'm proud of what I've done, I'm proud of the teaching I've been able to do, I've got people to ask questions they didn't ask before, I've given them tools to answer those questions. They don't always answer them the way I would have liked, but I know that they're going to be smarter, better able to contribute to society because of what I've done. That's a way better feeling of accomplishment than having made rich person A a little poorer to the advantage of rich person B or company A or I don't want to do that. That's not a fulfilling life. That's not a way to pass the time on earth that I have. I'd much rather be a teacher. And I didn't understand that when I made the decision. But looking back on it, that's one of the big good decisions I made. I made my share of bad ones, but that's a good one.
Yeah, and the thing is too is that like libertarians and other philosophies are always butting heads, and I've had my share of libertarians on the show. And one thing I love about libertarians, socialists, Marxists, I've even had people on from the Zeitgeist movement. Anybody who forces people to believe or realize that the system we have is not the system that we it's not the only system that can exist and that that we have. We're not stuck in this. We didn't get to this point because it was the best system, and we could still develop. We can still progress, and there are other ways of running a country or a culture or a society. And we don't have to, you know, we're not stuck here. And the other argument, too, is that, I mean, we've never, you know, people have said, oh, well, look at the socialist countries, this and that. Well, you know, and I've heard you say it, too. I mean, look at capitalist countries. First of all, you can make the argument that America, they love to talk about how capitalism got us where we are. But I mean, there's a lot of socialist programs like police officers. I mean, we have a small business construction company. We do state work. I mean, these roads and sidewalks that people are using, I mean, that's a socialist idea. We all invest as a society to have this service. You know, we invest for the postal service, for police, for schools, you know, whatever it may be. But those are socialist ideas. Those aren't capitalist ideas. It's like, would you want to remove all that? You know, so
exactly. I mean, that's the kind of thing I explain to them, too. Think about the absolute wonderfulness of a town park. In the middle of your community, here's a green area with trees and lawns and little ponds that is maintained collectively. We all put it, kick in our share of taxes, and we make a beautiful place where we can take our family on a picnic on Sunday afternoon and spend it there. And we're together with other people who can do it. We don't require you to shell out money. Everybody is equal. You go, you're a human being, and there's a feeling of togetherness and solidarity. It's priceless. It's not done by how much money you got. You know, where the only question is how much is in your wallet, not how you got it, not what kind of person you are to acquire it. Uh-uh. You could have stolen it. You could have inherited it. Who knows how you, we don't care in our system. You got the money, you get it. You don't have the money, you don't get it. You know, people say to me, the market brings you everything. I'm an economist. A market is a way of distributing scarce goods. That's all it ever was. But it's a very questionable way. If there's more people than there are ice cream cones, and the ice cream cone has been selling for $2 a pop, suddenly what happens? The people who have more money, knowing that there aren't enough to go around, they say, oh, I'll offer $4. And the others not to be outdone, well, I'll offer $6. And pretty soon people start dropping away because they come from families that can't afford to kick in $8 or $10 for an ice cream cone. And so all that's left who gets the scarce cones are the people with the most money. And I'd like to turn to my audience and I say, is your morality, your religion, your ethics, is that what you want? If the people with the most money are buying the scarce milk to feed to their cats, and the people who have less money but a brood of children are therefore going to have to go without, are you okay with that? You really want the market to decide? Come on. These are questions which, if you ask them in the right way, make people think and make people understand. But if I could add one thing, because you know our time is so often limited, I don't feel angry at the people who dismiss socialism, communism, Marxism, all of that, because I know it's in a way it's not their fault. You've lived in a country, you and I have lived in a country which for the last 75 years has demonized socialism and communism up and down the block. The church does it, the schools do it, the mass media do it, the politicians do it. How in the world do you expect people to have an honest evaluation of an alternative system if it's been drummed into them from the time they were children that this is all bad and evil and bad? You know, it's really childish. We've seen that in the world. We've seen societies fall apart who've been telling their own members, never do this. If you're Catholic, never look at the Protestant religion. If you're Protestant, never look at the Buddhist religion. It's evil, it's bad. More horror has been done in the name of this kind of behavior than I can recount, and we all know it. So we really, as a nation, do ourselves a favor. Open up the space to have some real discussions and debates so we can evaluate. capitalism has strengths and weaknesses, but so does socialism. And a rational human being who isn't demonized and scared out of his or her mind would want to have that kind of conversation as part of deciding what you're going to put your efforts to. And I don't blame the people who aren't ready for that yet. They're coming out of a kind of almost bear-like hibernation in a society that's been underground about these issues. And the irony is, the last point I want to make, the irony is I'm not surprised that Bernie Sanders is doing well. Because, you know, when you repress people, the other ideas don't disappear. They'll act like you're supposed to. But in their private soul, at night, crawled up under the covers or in front of the fire, they'll let their brain go there. And when finally someone stood up like Sanders, a nice, kindly old fellow from Vermont, you could allow that stuff to come up, and bingo, we see millions and millions of our fellow citizens perfectly happy with the label of socialist, want to talk about it, want to hear what the guy has to say. It makes me feel much better about the United States that it's able to do that. It's a kind of growing up, and it makes me feel good.
Yeah, I have a theory on why I think the popularity has grown. He has a big following in the young crowd. And I think the same reason why you see employers talk about how kids today, they don't want to work and all, they just want free time and all that stuff. And they look at it like it's a bad thing. Like, you know, doing things you enjoy doing compared to doing things you have to do. Like, that's not that's an easy choice for me. But, you know, the reason I think that is, one of the reasons I think, this is just my theory, is that, like, for example, when we were growing up, everything we enjoyed in life, so if it was movies, music, you know, driving your car, you had to put gas in it, just about everything involved money. So there was this sense of, like, everybody puts in your head, you need money to get the things you enjoy. So it was a means to an end, right? Where kids today with the internet, I mean, every kid has a cell phone and you could get free Wi-Fi just about at any Starbucks or grocery store. And kids are like, you know what? I don't need money. Like, all I can get music, videos, Professor Wolf's lectures, this podcast, all of it for free. Like, so I think that grip that money had on people's lives, it's loosening. Like, kids today are like, you know what, I don't really need that overtime because I don't really care if I, you know, make a couple extra $100. At least I have my weekend off and I can listen to that music or watch that documentary, spend some time on YouTube and watch some lectures. So to me, like, I think us going to the digital world, there's been a lot of good in regards to money not having a grip in our whole lives revolving around getting more of it and needing more of it and stressing about it and buying stuff you don't really need and then putting yourself in debt and then buying more stuff you don't really need, put yourself in debt, then you have to work to buy more. You know, it's this vicious cycle.
You know, I've learned, I couldn't agree with you more. I've learned, Ricardo, I've learned that from my students. You know, the story they tell me most often is, I grew up looking at my mother and my father. They worked themselves to the bone, but they were not happy people. I don't want to live like that. I love them. I feel for them. But I've learned, looking at them and being part of that family, that this was not a way to live. I appreciate the sacrifices they made. It helped me go to school. So these are not, you know, bad people, these young people. They're very thoughtful. They're very compassionate. But they say, I also have to learn not to do that again. And, you know, my mother told me, don't make the mistakes we did. And that's what I'm trying to do. And one of those mistakes was to run after money, to never question the system, to not explore the things that gave me pleasure, like music, like dance, like outdoors, like all the things I could have been, should have been. Maybe I made some mistakes. You're my child. I've done it for you. I got to give you the space to become your own person. And young people have been able to say, okay, and one of the decisions I'm going to make is I'm not going to live life the way you did. And that's the beginning of understanding you want a different system. You want a different society that gives you the chance to do that rather than putting endless obstacles in your way.
Yeah, you want more out of life. And you look at my parents' generation, you know, my parents aren't divorced, but many were divorced. You know, they're hard workers, but many of them were divorced. They're pill addicts. They're on anti-anxiety, antidepressants, or self-medicating with alcohol. I mean, that's what all this work and no play end up turning into.
Leads to.
Yeah, it leads to. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Christopher Ryan. He wrote the book, Civilized to Death. Yeah, and a great book that, you know, really, I can't recommend it enough. But I know you got to go, so I don't want to hold you up. I'd love to have you on again in the near future. Great conversation, Professor Wolf.
Good to meet you. I'm glad to talk with you, and I appreciate your understanding that I'm running around a little bit like a chicken without a head, and so I got to kind of budget my time.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I appreciate your work, and hopefully we talk again in the near future.
Okey-doke. We'll be glad to do it. Take care.
Take care. Thanks again, guys, for listening. Remember, these are just philosophies. Capitalism, socialism, Marxism, none of them are inherently evil, but there's obviously flaws in all of them. So if you haven't, go on YouTube, look at videos that explain Marxism, Karl Marx's history, his philosophy, some other people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, so many interesting philosophers and thinkers that I think when you really dive deep into that rabbit hole of learning what they, what were their ideas and what were their perspectives and philosophies on economics and the world, you'll find it very fascinating. So I definitely recommend you guys doing that. Also remember, like I told you in the beginning of the show, hit me up on social media, the Ripple Effect Podcast, Facebook page, RV36 on Twitter, RV36 on Instagram, my personal Facebook page, Ricky Verandas, our YouTube channel, RV36, where you can find the video version of this episode. And I will see you guys on the next one. Thanks. Peace.